Welcome to Season 2, Episode 9 of RPG Circus, the greatest show in gaming. In this episode, we listen to the rumors, we talk about mini campaigns, and finally, we have a little chat about using a book as your setting for your game. Again, welcome to Season 2, Episode 9 of RPG Circus. My name is Jeff, and joining me, as usual, is Zach and Mark. And welcome, guys. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Glad everyone could make it again.
Thank you.
Of course, as some of you may or may not know, Mark will be moving here shortly, right? So we may not have him for an episode or two. We're not quite sure yet. We have to work all that out.
Yeah.
But never fear, we will continue recording in his absence. And hopefully we'll arrange for a guest host if possible. If not, it will just be me and Zach.
Yeah.
So we'll go ahead and do that. Any additional comments before we head into the news?
No, let's get to it.
All right, yeah. Let's do the news. Right, first up in the news, of course, is the any submissions are closed for 2010, and what a list it is. We're kind of shocked and, I guess, and awed at the number of podcasts that have submitted this year. We have counted them, and it is 21 total. That is 2-1. By our reckoning, that is double what was submitted last year. And this on top of the new electronic submission rules, which was $5 for the first electronic submission and $10 for if you're submitting more than one electronic publication.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of interesting. I'm really happy that that happened. I was a little worried early on that there would just not be enough people who would submit in this category to warrant having the category, and the podcast would be relegated to another section.
Mm-hmm.
With that, the voting for the innies actually gets started in July. July 16th through to the 25th is when the voting period will be. And the nominees and the categories in which they will be placed will be July 9th. For people that don't know exactly how this works, correct me if I'm wrong, Zach, but the judges kind of decide where the submissions fall into the categories?
Yeah, sort of. It's kind of an any personnel decision, depending on how many entries they have and whatnot.
Right. Which is, we can argue the pros and cons of that at another date. The important thing is just that's why last year certain people were in certain categories and other people were in other categories. And that's just the way it goes. I mean, they make a command decision, and while we may not always agree with them, that's the way the awards work, and I'm just happy that there are enough podcasts that there will be a podcast category rather than being rolled into, I don't know. I'd hate to be competing against some of the blogs.
Yeah.
I think that would be a sad day for us. That said, I don't know. It seemed like the blogs were a little less represented this year than last year. Or is that just because I was amazed at the number of podcasts? I'm not sure. But there is quite a list of people. If you actually go to the any web pages and then go to their blog, and you click on submissions, you'll actually see the list of all the submissions that are there. And there is a list, and it's quite impressive. And for the print material, that means each of the judges got a copy of that piece of material to look at for judging purposes. I don't think I'd want that mail.
Yeah.
On a little bit of a lesser note, if you've been following the blogs at all, you know this happened, but artist Frank Frazetta died? That's how you pronounce his last name? Frazetta?
That's always how I pronounce it.
I think so, yeah.
And, I guess as you described him, Zach, he was kind of brought forth a certain style to some of the Conan comics. That's kind of where he really brought forth some of the fantasy influences. Do I have that right?
Oh yeah, he was very big in into the Conan. I guess the certain sort of sword and sorcery look that we associate with Conan, sort of the you know, very muscle bound warrior, kind of gritty combat, very lush, I guess, voluptuous damsels in distress.
You can I guess we can say stacked.
Yeah, musty stacked. Yeah. Whatever you want to say. There's definitely there was junk in the trunk. Okay, but yes. You know, and that's you know, there's certainly people divided on his work because a lot of people, you know, don't complain about objectifying and whatnot. But however you come down on that, and I'm not going to offer an opinion on that because I'm not crazy. But
right.
Either way,
my thought on the matter is this: his artwork was at a time period in which gore was a fairly popular series. You know, think about that for a little while.
you got to kind of look at it that way, I guess. But he was influential. I mean, from the Conan comics, the lead artist for the Legend of Zelda series, which I guess I don't see the direct correlation, but says he was a big influence. So certainly for gaming as well, I think he kind of brought about, kind of encouraged a metal fantasy kind of feel to a lot of people's games.
A lot of Dark Sun type looking stuff.
Mm-hmm. Very, very, very much so. Very much so. But any kind of Googling for Frank Frazetta will show you some examples if you're not familiar with the gentleman's art.
And we actually will have a link to his Wikipedia entry in the show notes.
Oh, very good.
So, another news, and this is one I didn't know until I read this announcement, Green Ronin is they released the cover to their DC Adventures Heroes Handbook.
Yeah.
Which is going to be basically DC comic book characters and a game system based on mutants and masterminds. Mm-hmm. Now, this is very interesting because I didn't know that anyone was working on any DC-related material for RPGs. Did you
guys? They hadn't been. There was an old DC superheroes game back in the day, but
I believe that
Mayfair
was
did that.
Six system.
Yeah, I think that was through Mayfair games, if memory serves me
Mayfair,
right.
I believe it was. Yeah,
and I know some people that actually claim that that system was superior to almost any other super system out there. Interesting note about that is, if memory serves me, the reason that they picked up the DC title was they originally wrote the game for Marvel, but TSR picked up the Marvel license before they did. So they actually had a game, a super game system, you know, super's game system that didn't have a setting, and they needed to get one. Yeah. So they got the DC license instead and released it. And I know some people that just say that that was the way to the game for supers for the longest time. So it's kind of exciting. I'm glad to see that somebody's doing something in the DC universe, because every supers, you know, publisher, Marvel and DC, both need a little love in this area.
Well, that's true. I'm interested. Is it going to be a standalone product? Have we seen?
I believe so.
I think so too. From the way it's been described.
I guess if it's based on Mutants and Masterminds, right. It's going to be. Yeah.
They also just released an announcement that they're going to be doing Mutants and Masterminds 3rd Edition. It's going to be coming out the same time as the DC book.
Which makes you wonder if it's going to be based off of the newer rules.
Yes, they said that it's actually going to have the same rules as the new Mutants and Masterminds.
Well, that's exciting. I've actually never played Mutants and Masterminds. It's one of my shortcomings.
It's one of the best supported. I'm not a big fan of it personally. My superhero gaming tends towards other systems. But if you look at just the sheer amount of titles for Mutants and Masterminds, they release a lot of stuff. Wow. Definitely. It'll be interesting to see how they handle the transition to a 3rd edition and how compatible it is backwards.
Yeah, compatibility is always a big one in those type of systems.
It is.
Well, in news that I'd rather not comment on, but it is important news. WotC had some more departures of personnel. We have a note that Andy Collins has left. I don't know how to pronounce this one. Tora Cottrell? Or Cottrell apparently has been laid off. And there's also word that Peter Schaefer and Jesse Decker have also left. Now, what's interesting about Andy Collins actually leaving is you remember way back in January when the Hasbro announced a position at WotC?
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, mm-hmm. that position was originally going to report to Andy Collins. So, I find that kind of amusing in my own way.
Yeah.
You know, because we had comment. It's like, I don't know if I'd want that job working at WotC unless I only plan to work there for a year. So,
Unfortunately, that's kind of something that just, I think with Wizards of the Coast, on one hand, you get to create for the most popular gaming company out there, but on the other hand, they're pretty notorious now for turnover.
Well, I think most people who work there now kind of think of it as a stepping stone to other things in the industry.
Yeah, because I haven't really seen too many people. Yeah, I haven't seen too many people who got let go from WotC and then just disappeared. They usually end up doing pretty well for themselves elsewhere in the hobby.
If not working for another company, starting their own little publishing houses.
Exactly. Yeah. So.
It's still never fun to lose your
Yeah, no, I agree.
So.
Well, again, it depends.
But best of luck to them, certainly.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm sure we'll be hearing from all of them at some time in the future. In other WotC news, there has been a major update for D&D 4th Edition that was just released at the beginning of the month. Getting over a little bit of a cold. It is I don't even know how many pages it is. It's just huge, from what I understand. It's a big download. Some of the highlights for rule changes is acrobatics. You can now hop down 10 feet without falling prone. There's some aid and other changes. Apparently, you can aid attack and aid defense at the same time. Is that the way that I read that? And not playing 4th edition, I have no idea exactly what these mean. There's some major changes with mounts and flying and stuff, and there's some force movement changes, and apparently there's some power changes and some changes and clarifications to the charge action. So if you play 4th edition, I guess read it at your leisure and decide whether or not you agree with any of the rule changes and play them or not.
How many pages was it? I didn't get to the end of it here. I just saw the highlights.
You know, I actually didn't download it since I don't actually know the rules well enough. It seemed pointless to me.
Now, Mark, we were talking about the show, and you were saying your group that isn't really big, and you're not one of those groups that pours over new errata and, you know, instantly changes or...
No, because my group doesn't really focus on the rules as much as the story and just having fun. So if a certain power is overpowered, nobody really notices. So I've never used errata ever. I buy the book and I just follow what's in the book and don't worry about, you know, what they've put out that they've needed to change.
Now for D&D, I've never really used errata, but for other systems I have, because, well, in some of the systems, the only way the rules actually work is because the errata is there. You know, like,
yeah.
Oh, there's a missing skill description. I've actually had that in a game, and it's like, without the errata, I have no idea what the skill is or how it works or what it covers or, or there's a reference to another skill that doesn't exist or something, something silly like that, or point costs or, you know, just like, for example, the old traveler, striker rules. You can't really build anything without the errata, because the errata actually has clarifications and replacement tables for stuff that they just completely screwed up.
Really?
Well, remember, that was back in the 70s when, you know, you make a typesetting error, everything's off by a column or two.
That's true, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So,
Jeff, I was reminded of another Traveler product with this, and that was the Traveler 4th Edition errata by Imperium Games, which is still legendary. And you can go out and just... You can find the Traveler 4th Edition errata online very simply, but it is hilarious how much there is.
It's upwards of like 30-some-odd pages, isn't it?
It's ridiculous. So any 4th Edition fans, if you're somewhat depressed about a sizable errata coming out recently, just look at the Traveler 4th Edition errata and feel much better about it.
Yes, feel better about yourself.
So that's still the standard
Yeah, at least this fourth edition isn't because of bad editing. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
It's because
they... clarification or revision or whatever.
This because they not... just decided something just plain sucked.
And really, yeah. you can playtest something for years. And in the end, at the minute gamers get a hold of it, mm-hmm. you're basically screwed.
I don't know of anyone who's ever made a perfect product that has needed no clarification or no
erotic. Exactly.
Yeah. So, and some closing news. We have a little free supplement for those who play Pathfinder. And I guess, obviously, D&D 3.5, there's Necromancers of the Northwest. They released a free PDF called Into the Armory. It has a few odds and ends of equipment, some of it magical. And so far, one of the more amusing ones is... even though it actually says in the description it's not Rust Monster Armor, it's called Rust Monster Armor. And that was kind of amusing. You know, I think the effect was something like, if a non-magic weapon hits, you still take the damage, but then the weapon is affected by a Rusting Grasp or whatever the spell is. Off the top of my head, I don't remember. But I thought that was kind of amusing. And it's a free PDF, nice. So... heck, it's always worth a good look to see.
Why not?
And it's a funny company name. Kind of the...
yeah.
Instead of Wizards of the Coast, you have Necromancers of the Northwest.
Yeah.
I had a friend who wanted to start up a company called Sorcerers on the Beach. which he never got it off the ground, but I still think of that a lot.
Sorcerers on the Beach. I actually like that.
Mm-hmm. And he had this little illustration of a guy, little wizard with his pointy hat sitting on a lounge chair. With a sun umbrella. It was cute, but
much better than some of the old TSR logos.
I
actually remember back in the 80s that the TSR logo was very close, in my mind, to the Procter & Gamble logo.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Go back and look.
If you actually look at the old Dungeons & Dragons Red Book, the actual logo that they have there, and then you pull a Procter & Gamble logo that has a little face on it. They're really close. I'm surprised. I'm surprised they never got sued.
I'm looking at it now. Actually, the little Procter & Gamble face. That's weird. that's not right.
But you know, that's just the way it goes. So, unfortunately, we do have some sadder notes here at RPG Circus. One of our fellow bloggers has had a recent tragedy. Steve Niblink? I can't pronounce his last name. Everyone mostly knows him from his blogger name of Vulcanstev. His wife, Virginia, unfortunately lost her battle with cancer. And one of our other bloggers, the Game Traveler, Daniel Perez, has set up a donation fund to help Steve out in these troubling times. So we will, there in the show notes, there will be a link to the, I think, the tip jar that he set up for that. Mm-hmm. And he's
I'll just note that Steve or Vulcanstev has always been a really good contributor and just a all around nice guy online. Really,
absolutely
published some interesting stuff. So it's a hard time for him, but our thoughts are definitely with him. And if people do feel inclined to donate, it's definitely going through something like that. I'm sure I can't even imagine the financial expense, let alone the emotional expense of your whole life being uprooted like that.
Yeah, it's a tough thing, especially if you never planned for it. So, having actually gone to a funeral recently and have had a funeral in the last few years, another funeral for my own father in the last few years, it's a tough time. So, hopefully, our wishes are with him, and hopefully things will get better for him. I think I think we're just going to end the news section on that, and we're going to start getting into the topics. How's that sound?
Sounds fine.
All right. Well, is it true or is it false? Rumors have been a legacy of gaming as far back as I can personally remember. I mean, let's face it. I think that was kind of partially the introduction to gaming. I think almost all the first modules I ever played had some sort of rumor mill in them. So with that, let's have a little listen, shall we?
Oh, cool. I'm batting lead off tonight. So
absolutely.
Yep, Jeff alluded to there. Tonight's topic for me will be rumor has it. Rumors are a great thing to use in your game. like many of the things we talk about on the show, they can be used in a number of different ways. They can enhance your game, or they can really detract from it. So how do you use rumors? How do you make good rumors that further your game and further the sense of mystery and adventure? And how do you tie it all together? Well, tonight, while we're podcasting here, I'm looking at one of my favorite works, is Keep on the Borderlands.
I was gonna say Keep on the Borderlands.
Oh yeah,
of course.
I think that is the go-to standard.
It pretty much is. If I'm going to look at how something was handled back in the day, I'm probably going to be looking at Keep on the Borderlands. So, in Keep on the Borderlands, like other earlier modules, there is a rumor table. And some of the rumors are true, some are false, but basically you're supposed to potentially gather this information from the inhabitants. You know, roll a d20 and see. Some of the rumors have an F by them that says it's false. So, of course, one of my favorite is Bree Yark is Goblin for We Surrender, which it is not for We Surrender. So, altars are very dangerous. If you get lost, beware the Eater of Men. An ogre sometimes helps the cave dwellers. Now, I've been in games before where, I kid you not, the DM or the game master has actually just told us items like, we go up to the character, you know, we ask the bartender if anything's going on in town. And the bartender will say something like, tribes of different creatures live in different caves. now, obviously that was not an experienced DM, and he was doing his best, you know, but... I know it's awful, but bless his heart, you know what, he was so enthusiastic, it was hard to hold it against him. He really did, and he got markedly better as the campaign went on, but I'll never forget that.
That's good.
But it should not, when you're dealing with rumors, they should not read like something on a Nintendo RPG, like the old Nintendo Entertainment System. It shouldn't read like press talk next to a person, because that's what they used to do. If you remember the old Nintendo Entertainment System RPGs, early consoles, you'd walk around to everybody in town and they'd be like, the Moonstone's hidden in the North Cave. Well, you know, that's fine for an 8-bit RPG, but if you have your players walking around town and people are just saying all this cryptic stuff, you know, or all these rumors, it kind of detracts from the game somewhat, I think. And so, to a point, I have three things that I feel should be emphasized on rumors. They should have some matter of subtlety, as just illustrated. They should be mixed with falsehoods or fallacies. They shouldn't always be true. Mm-hmm. And they shouldn't always be game killers if they're missed. So,
that's a good one, the last one.
Yeah.
Yeah, and actually, I'll go in reverse. I'll touch on that one first, because it kind of works like almost like clues in Call of Cthulhu. And that's one of the big mistakes I think people make. A lot of Cthulhu GMs I've talked to talk about that. You know, you missed one manuscript and your game is done, tanked. There's no way to recover from it. And rumors can be the same way. If you miss the fact that the old blind beggar was talking about the black dragon in the canyon could only be killed by this way, well, you know, your players aren't always on their A game, and what's clear to you isn't always clear to the players. Yeah, if ever. You know, I know as a GM, I'm not on my A game a lot. So, you know, just because I think a clue is incredibly clear, or this rumor, you know, is incredibly clear, it's probably not. You know, people process in different ways. So there's a couple ways to get around there. There's repetition. Of course, there's some sort of redundancy, having another clue. There's different avenues. Making your game somewhat less linear is probably just the best basic way I know to deal with that.
I would have to say that the sandbox concept for rumors works really well.
Sure, yeah.
You know, I mean, let's face it, Keep on the Borderlands has always been kind of put up as an example of kind of a sandbox setting, too. So. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Yeah.
And there's nothing in there that railroads you into a certain
direction, step. Action.
Right, right, you know. Sure. And you know, players, you know, on one hand, while you don't want them to be game killers if they're missed, going back to my first point, you don't want them to just be overt either. Because there's something that seems inorganic and sort of a mood killer if you just go up to the merchant in town and he tells you to beware the dragon's fang or whatever. You know, people don't talk like that.
Yeah.
People have hearsay. They know that Old Man Johnson's daughter disappeared in the woods 3 years ago. They know that weird howls have been heard on the mountain when the wind's just right. Rumors, I think rumors are best when they're evocative, they're somewhat murky, and they don't end the game
And if you have to have some sort of weird proclamation speech, it should come from a crazy person.
Always remember the loonies. That's a good point.
You know.
But then again, with your loonies, I think we've also gotten to the point in some people's games where every crazy old man is held up as a soothsayer or a wise prophet. And sometimes crazy old men are just crazy old men.
I was actually going to originally name Dice Monkey, the blog, as the old man at the bar.
Oh, wow, Mark, that'd have been a good one. I like that.
Yeah.
So, I was going to say one more note on this is what I mentioned before should be mixed with falsehoods or fallacies. Not every rumor should be true, and that kind of goes into old man at the bar as well. You know, the old man at the bar, unless he is omniscient, is not omniscient. So, you know, if basically, like, if he's not a god in disguise, he's probably got some crazy, crazy things, you know, and this goes for fantasy games or modern games or whatever. You can have a retired, senile old CIA agent who's pretty sure that Harry Truman was actually a walnut, but at the same time, he might have some pretty good insight on some things.
You know, or the guy might just be completely wrong. He gets it set in his mind that it's a certain way, and it doesn't matter what anyone else says.
Yeah, and I think you want to look at your rumors to, you know, your truth to fallacy ratio, basically.
And don't forget the partial truths.
Yeah, and of course there's partial truths as well. You know, Keep on the Borderlands, I believe, had 13 out of 20 rumors that were true. Or at least, you know, even if in a vague way. You know, now some GMs might find that high and just really want to frustrate. Of course, you can also do partial truths. You know, there's something in the woods, but it's not a dragon. You know, stuff like that. So, there's a number of ways to go around using rumors, but those are the three things I try to remember when you use them. I'm not sure about you guys, but I kind of wanted to see how you use rumors in your game and if you follow along some of the same guidelines or if you have additional guidelines.
Pardon me, I'm recovering from a cold still.
That's all right.
If I... wow, that's not what I wanted to do. Mostly in my games, I kind of go the route of, I've kind of, even though I like the concept of rumors, I've kind of fallen out of the favor of using them because, unfortunately, with the time constraints of when I play, rumors aren't just something I get to use. If I did a sandbox campaign, probably yes.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly, usually, if I create a rumor, I want to create someone who is going to give it to avoid that the merchant says this. No. If there's a rumor, it's going to be a particular person that has that rumor. You know, that way you tailor, you know, what the rumor is to the person, or you create a person for that rumor to give. Because, you know, certain people are going to know certain things. The librarian isn't going to know about the thieves at the dock. Unless, well, he's actually one of the thieves at the dock.
Right.
You know. So.
Well, I think you can also have rumors interlock like that. The librarian knows one thing and doesn't seem to make much sense, but then you talk to the guy down on the wharf and maybe it makes a little more sense.
Actually, you know what else kind of used some sort of rumors or information was the Pathfinder Second Darkness kind of had that feel, had some of that in it with the first adventure.
Mm.
And it was like, you could actually, they were like knowledge rolls where you could actually gain certain information based on your knowledge roll. And that kind of, I don't know if the, I think all of that information was mostly true, but it kind of reminded me of the rumor system. You know, mm-hmm. And so especially like in D&D 3.5, if I was to do that again, that's kind of how I would do it. It's like, you know, well, these knowledge rolls would possibly give you this these information and these rumors, because I mean it's knowledge. It doesn't necessarily mean it's true. I think that's a fallacy that people say. Well, I made this knowledge roll. Well, yeah. Well, what does it cover? It isn't going to tell you the absolute truth, because well, it's a knowledge roll based on the knowledge that the world currently has. It doesn't mean that it's right.
You could also, in some systems, do a hidden gather information roll and dispense information on that. You know, your bard goes out and carouses or whatever, but he doesn't know that he's been talking to the biggest liar in three counties.
Exactly.
Yes.
So, well,
there's a number of fun ways to handle
it. Just any other way. The Mega Traveler had one of their skill things was an uncertain task where you roll the dice for your task and I roll the dice for the task. And only if we both succeed does it actually happen. So you could have a partial success, which means that some, you know, whatever you try to gather is untrue, whatever. Some, you know, there are ways to work that. So I'm sorry, yeah. I cut somebody off.
In the Rebellion Era source book, they had some really good knowledge rolls that would give you certain information. Including going all the way up to the, like, if you scored a 40 on your knowledge roll, then you knew that the Emperor was actually a Sith Lord and that Darth Vader was formerly Anakin Skywalker and all this different stuff. But at lower levels, if you just didn't roll well in your knowledge, then your character just didn't know what was really going on in the Empire. They just knew that the Empire was the government and did what it had to do to keep its citizens safe and things like that. So I see that as sort of the same thing as what you were talking about, Jeff. Yeah. But I haven't really used rumors too often in my games either, because it's probably the same thing. It's a time constraint. So usually we just move the plot from one place to the next and don't usually slow down to really chat with NPCs.
That's right. You move the baby Huey that is the party from one location to another, so they just crush each location as you go.
Basically.
Well, you got any closing comments on that there, Zach?
Oh, no, those were my basic points on it. Okay. So definitely, if any readers or any, sorry, listeners, I was in blog mode. If any listeners have any ways they handle rumors or any good anecdotes along those lines, we'd love to hear them.
Absolutely. Well, in the second set, Mark, you're going to tell us a little bit about mini campaigns. I know that sometimes I think a mini campaign is just the thing, because you may have. I sometimes have this idea for a set of adventures, but it doesn't really fit my current campaign, and it's not something that I want to do long term. So
yeah, I don't know what you're saying about sometime. That's me all the time. I am always coming up with new ideas for campaigns, and I'll mention it to my players, and usually there's just a long sigh of really something else, but we usually end up just sticking with the exact same game. Ever since 4th edition came out, I've been running 4th edition straight through. We've been switching up between, we switched the campaigns three times in it, but it still was just 4th edition. And as much as I would like to go off and play some Mouse Guard or play some Savage Worlds, we just usually settle for what's easiest, which is 4th edition. Yeah. So
well, I can understand that. I really can.
Yeah, exactly. Especially when you have such time constraints. We're only playing about 3 hours a week, so you don't really have time to sit down and learn new rules. So what I was thinking, once I move and finally find a gaming group, is instead running mini campaigns where you are basically, yeah.
Okay.
But you were talking about mini campaigns and how you really hadn't been playing a lot. You're switching games. You just really haven't been switching games.
Yeah. So I was thinking about once I actually move and get a new gaming group, I'm thinking that I'll try running mini campaigns where it'll be maybe 4 to 6 weeks for each campaign, and there'll be a definite beginning, a middle, and an end. And then switching up not just games but game systems. So I'm able to do things like Savage Worlds and Warhammer Fantasy, and doing a little Dark Heresy maybe, and some 4th edition and Spycraft. Oh,
on another note,
yeah.
Michael wants to actually have you run Warhammer at Gen Con when we're there.
Yeah, I've been chatting with him. So anybody who's interested in playing some Warhammer, I'll be running some of that at Gen Con, probably on Saturday or Sunday.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Sorry, I digress, but that just popped into my head.
Yeah. But with your game, you're going to need to, if you're running a mini campaign, you definitely need to set very specific guidelines. Normally, if I'm running a D&D game, the players will just come up with general character concepts and we'll just run with it and figure out a way to fit them all in. But that takes time. And if you're running a mini campaign where you're only spending a few weeks per game, you're going to want to maximize the amount of actual playtime. So, for example, if you're running a 4th edition game, you'd want to tell people, you know, okay, we're going to be playing a campaign that's more focused on divine characters. You don't necessarily have to have a divine character, but your character has to have some type of belief in a specific deity that you're focusing on. If you're playing a superheroes game, you're going to want to tell the players, you know, listen, we're playing mutants working for Professor Xavier, so make sure your character is a mutant and a hero. You don't want to have one person be like, well, I secretly want to be a villain, and eventually you can find out they're actually a villain and they're working against you. Now, you could have that as part of your plot, that one of the players is secretly a supervillain, and then reveal that in the big final session.
I guess my question is that in this situation, would you want to go more with possibly have some pre-gens for people, or would you want to do more like, these are kind of the templates that I was thinking of?
I would think you'd do more like templates, just so the players really still had ownership of their characters. I think for some, it would be a lot easier to do pre-gens if it's a brand new system that nobody's familiar with. Just so that you can say, here's your character, you know, make sure it's all, the game master makes sure it's all balanced, and then just go with it from there. But if it's a system that everybody knows, then you can probably just sort of tell them we're going for a specific template.
I guess the other advantage too is in, you know, like in a game system that has levels, obviously you could choose a certain power level as well.
Exactly, yeah. And you don't have to worry about loot or XP at all, because you don't have to worry about making sure the players are able to level up and have all the right gear. You can set that up from the beginning and focus. Your focus is mainly going to be on your story. So I think that actually helps a lot with not worrying about making sure every single encounter is specifically balanced. It gives you the chance also to focus on, you could tweak the rules to be more to your liking for a specific game. You can, you know, bump up all damage to double damage for the game just to make it a much more deadlier game. You can experiment a little bit with the rules. Have you any of you guys run mini campaigns ever?
I actually did a short run Savage World game.
Yeah.
You know, kind of a pulpy thing. We ran a couple of sessions.
Mm-hmm. That worked pretty well?
They liked the Savage World. They liked the pulp. I just didn't have enough material for more than a couple adventures.
Yeah.
So, otherwise we'd still be playing it. And I guess technically the Where No Man Has Gone Before game that I ran a couple of sessions of was kind of effectively a mini campaign of its own.
Mm-hmm.
That was actually a lot of fun. And, you know, you just, in that case, there wasn't really any large adventure designs. It was just like, okay, Star Trek, the original series, you know, pour in a little camp and go.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Very nice.
Well, you know, I think one of the nice benefits of running that, and my games tend to veer between either one-shots or, like, sustained campaigns. But the mini-arc, much like a one-shot, kind of gives you... I think there's less objection from the players if a character dies.
Oh, yeah.
During a mini-arc, you know, you don't have that special snowflake syndrome quite as much.
Special snowflake? I don't think I've actually heard it that way before.
You know, you killed Blackleaf sort of thing. So, I mean, you know, it's a... You know, and like you said, you can do some new things and change it up a little bit. The other point is that there's so many, I don't know about you guys, but I have so many games on my shelf that I think that I probably will never get to play.
Exactly.
I mean, I
want to, but, you know, if my group, you know, we all have, most of us have kids now, we all have jobs and responsibilities.
Damn those responsibilities, interfering with my gaming.
I know. I mean, how do we get to all these games? It just doesn't seem fair.
You know,
and that's why I think mini campaigns work.
Sure, sure. I think they work much better as you get older. Mm-hmm. And I think that as you grow older, playing for six sessions, Savage Worlds or what have you, then playing six sessions of In Harm's Way, and then playing six sessions of Truth and Justice or whatever, works a little bit better, because I think when I was 17 I wanted that epic, not that I still don't, but you know, we played that game and that was the game we played, we would play it for a year in that campaign.
Trust me, as a teenager I gamed Friday night for 6+ hours, Saturday for 12 to 14 15 hours, and Sunday for 6 hours.
Yeah.
We had Friday night campaigns and Saturday night campaigns when I was a young airman in Korea. And, I mean, we, for the year that I was there, pretty much, that is what we did from 6 p.m. until about 2 in the morning, both nights.
Wow.
If not later. And, I mean, that's what we did. And I can't see us doing that now, but... you know, we were tied in on each night to one system. That's what we ran.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and to be fair, back then, I didn't quite know that there was the cornucopia of awesome games that I know is out there now.
Oh, yeah.
I think that's where we were all at back then. Mm-hmm. At least for, sure. I guess, people of my age. You know, I sometimes feel like the far out old man at game conventions these days. But I'm not that old. So. But yeah, mini campaigns, I like the idea. I think sometimes, though, you have to get the right group, because there's a lot of gamers that do want that continuation. That was kind of the problem mm-hmm. that I had with Savage Worlds. I purposely said, you know what, we're only going to run maybe one or two game session, you know, one or two adventures with this. And they liked it so much, they wanted to continue. I just didn't have the material for it. And that's kind of the hidden danger of the mini campaign, is that, you know, if the players get really attached to things, obviously, you know, you either, as the game master, either have to say, nope, we're not going to do anymore, or you might have to turn your mini campaign into a full-blown campaign at some point.
Well, one thing, too, that I think works well is that, in the end, if your players really, really like their characters, you can... leave them for a few months and then come back and do another mini campaign with the exact same characters.
Good point.
Maybe even bumping them up a few levels to represent, you know, a little bit of time passing, things like that. So I think that would actually work as well in the case that the players really, really became attached to their characters.
Mm-hmm. Very true. Well, are there any major closing comments at this juncture for this section?
I don't think so.
Did we cover everything?
I think so. I think we got it all.
Well, moving on from the mini campaign, let's go in a slightly familiar and dark territory, and that is the book. The fantasy novel, the science fiction novel, and actually using that for your campaign. This is the great groan of many a gamer, where the inexperienced game master has read the latest great novel of his life and has decided that's where his campaign is going to be. That's his setting. Now, it can be done successfully. but you kind of got to follow a few rules. And the first one is, of course, to actually have read the material. I don't know about you, but I've actually run across people that think they've read the material, but they haven't.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, actually read the book. If there's more than one book in the series, you kind of have to read all the books that are available to you. That isn't, you know, that said, sometimes you might choose a certain stopping point. The second most important thing is, if you can find a map in the book, get one. You know, mm-hmm. If the most fantasy worlds that actually have a very complex geography will usually have a map, even a very simple one. I don't know how many fantasy books I've read that didn't have some sort of odd, you know, little map, even if it doesn't quite make cardiological sense.
Yeah.
So, and now that you've, and of course, once you've done those type of things, the most important thing to do, change things. I don't know how many times people try to run settings verbatim. And the important thing is it's a setting. You have to change things, you know. And there's lots of ways to do that, you know. Either, you know, it's set in the past, it's set in the future from the books. I tend to like to set it, if I was going to use a book as the basis, it would definitely be set in the future. I don't like doing things in the past because then players are like, well, I know where this item is. Yeah. So you say. It's kind of like I once played, you know, let's one of the classics, you know, the Middle Earth role playing game, and you know the Middle Earth setting, and it's like, you know, the guy chose to run it before, you know the Middle Earth stories. Well, that's great. Of course, at that time, you know that the players with their player knowledge, not actual character knowledge, know that, oh, the ring's out over that way, you know, Gollum has the ring. Well, you know, the Game Master has to just say, of course, you guys personally know the ring's there, but no, you're never going to get there. Sorry, goodbye. And that just seems rude to do that. The important thing is to you have to make changes. Maybe the ring isn't there in your game world. Maybe it's in another location if you were going to use Middle Earth. Of course, you know, we don't have to actually guess on Middle Earth if you actually have the old MERP material. There's enough of it there that you don't have to write a thing.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. The MERP material, I mean, it was a full-fledged supplement to Lord of the Rings.
Right. And some of it was inaccurate, but that's okay.
That's all right.
Again, the point is that it was a way to make the game run, not necessarily a 100% accurate to the books, because the game world wasn't the book. That's a big distinction.
Most Middle-earth games I've seen either run in the Second Age or the Fourth Age, which sort of sidestep a lot of the issues nicely.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a lot of Star Wars games will do the Old Republic or in the future, but that becomes increasingly difficult with the amount of Star Wars material that's still being produced.
I can't imagine running Middle-earth in the Fourth Age, though, because basically at the end of Lord of the Rings, when they say, and then it moved into the Fourth Age, it's basically them saying, and then things got boring and Earth-like.
But it does take a while, is what I've always seen.
Yeah.
Certainly things are ebbing, but they're not there yet. There's still remnants out there from Mordor and whatnot, and there's still other, you know. But, yeah, I think one thing to keep in mind with novels and whatnot, using those for a setting, is the same thing, I've talked about this before, is running into the dreaded canonista that you run into a lot with, for example, Forgotten Realms is a big one.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that you have to have read this, and this. Like you say, Jeff, change things.
Right. Well,
you have to have players that are on board with that.
Right. Well, which is why we're going to, you know, another step, of course, is that now that you know what your changes are, the map probably has changed a little bit. You need to update your map.
Mm.
And the last thing, of course, is you need to inform the hell out of the players. You know, a few, you know, back in the day, you know, it would be like 3 or 4 typewritten pages maybe. Nowadays, you can have something on an Obsidian portal that explains your changes, or you can have your own little website, or, you know, little wiki that you have on your own website or whatnot, or just some linked web pages or whatever you want to do. Hell, even just a Word document. We have all these electronic documents. And, you know, I'm going to send you the PDF, whatever the case may be. But have, you know, some have the changes written out, have them spelled out, and the players need to be informed. They need to know that, yes, it's based on this book, but it is not the book. I think that's the most important thing. Because you're right, you know, the people who say, this is wrong, this is absolutely wrong, they would never do this. Well, guess what? You know, the old parallel Earth theory? There you go. Same thing. Game world, parallel game world.
Yeah.
And I think that's where we, you know, especially like for Rotten Realms, I mean, that's actually even more dangerous because now you have a setting, a setting book, and then, of course, you had all those novels that were set in that setting. And that's super dangerous in a way. Because, you know, you're right. Yeah. You know, you have, not only do you have game material, but now you have novels that are kind of based on the game material. And you're just like, okay, I don't know if that quite works the way I want it to work. You know, and just, and of course, that's the problem with any great work of, you know, either, even if it's game material, we've talked about it before, you know. When you're running a setting, you should be, you know, if you're the game master, you should be the final authority on what is going on in the game universe. So if just because you don't have, you know, the Raiders of the North supplement, you've designed your own Raiders of the North, you know, it doesn't mean that, you know, if it comes out, you don't need that module. You know, you don't need that expansion. You don't need to backdate things unless you really want to. And players shouldn't say, well, I have this, and that's not the way they act. They have bronze spears, not copper spears. Who cares?
Yeah.
You know? They don't worship the horsehead god. Well, I decided they do. Thank you.
Yeah.
So, you know, they demand you as a blood sacrifice. Thanks. Next. So, but I mean, those are the important things. I mean, it's a dangerous subject, but I bring it up because I think that, you know, if you're willing, because there's a lot of material, there is a lot of good fantasy material out there that, in book form, that there really isn't a game for. You know, there isn't a setting, you know. There are great settings out there, and at the very least, you know, as they always say, one thing about RPGs is you can plagiarize some, and no one's going to sue you at that point, because it's a game.
Yep.
You're not, you know, as long as you don't release the material for sale, you know, and There's the old saying that there really is nothing new. It's all.
Let me ask you guys this: what book would you most like to see turned into an RPG setting that is not currently or is out of print?
That is an excellent question. Oddly enough, there are a few. one of my personal old favorites was the Guardian of the Flame series by Joel Rosenberg.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was good.
You know, which is kind of funny because the first book was kind of a quasi-D&D game at the beginning. But once you get past that intro and get further in the book, it's kind of interesting. Actually, his other series of books, his Paladin series, is actually kind of interesting, but that's kind of an alternate medieval Europe setting. I don't know if you guys have read those.
No, I haven't.
No, I've read the first series there that you mentioned, but not the second.
God, I mean, there's lots of them. I mean, being an old school person, I actually wouldn't mind actually, some of the old Edgar Rice Burroughs books. I think would make some pretty interesting settings. Never mind, they're very anachronistic at this point. So,
yeah, those would be awesome.
And I think there have been attempts at that in the past.
I think you're right, but I can't think of what right now.
Yeah. So,
I've got two. One is the Belgariad by David Eddings.
Oh, very good. Yeah.
Yeah. It's got a really huge, rich world, and there's enough history in there that you could pretty much find any point in history and have a group of characters. The only thing is that you'd pretty much just have non-magical characters because the wizards are few and far between.
Rare.
But you know, that's I think that's a setting decision. You know, some games.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the setting.
That might be one of mine too, Mark. The thing I'd like about that is that it's stable. Some would say repetitive. I'll say stable.
Yes.
In that the groups through history stay largely the.
Yeah, they're the same.
As an archetype or stereotype to
exactly.
Drop a person in. So.
And the story always repeats itself as like the sort of the theme behind the book series.
Right.
So you could pretty much have the same adventure, just going to a different, completely different location, retrieving a completely different thing, and you know, and it would be legit. The other one is. There's no role-playing game for Harry Potter. And I think it would make a phenomenal role-playing game.
Haven't there been some online attempts at something like that, though?
There's a metric ton of freeform Harry Potter chats and whatnot out there.
Yeah. And there was there's one called Broomsticks that's a pretty rules-light version. And the Witch Girls RPG, it's... not for Harry Potter, but they have a section right at the beginning. They say, we understand if you want to use these rules to play a game about a certain boy wizard. And if so, here are the changes you need to make to the rules. And they have a single page on, you know, remove these types of magic and do this type of thing. And instead of having the different character types, you instead have the houses.
Huh. Interesting.
But there's no official role-playing game, and from what I've heard,
not likely.
J.K. Rowling said there never will be, as long as she's alive.
Well, you know, that's okay.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I actually think that if they actually did do one officially, it'd probably get some sort of weird cheese factor in there.
I think so, absolutely.
So I mean I think that's why sometimes I think if you do it yourself in that regard, you're actually a little better off, because you know
yeah.
You can make these canned decisions of what you think's important, what aspects of material do you want to bring forward, because every designer is going to want to bring something else forward, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Now one thing that we haven't mentioned is that sometimes, and this is important, for a particular setting. You have to know the ramifications of the game system you're using on the setting.
Yeah.
And I can't stress that enough. Standard D&D might not work with certain settings. And I know there are people out there who will go like a blasphemy, but it's true. That's why we have this plethora of games. Because not one particular game, and I say that again, not one particular game is perfect for every genre or setting. So that's why I like so many games, because certain games make more sense for certain settings and genres.
Oh yeah.
So mm-hmm. And I think that's just about it for me on that. I've evangelized enough. I guess quick question, have any of you guys actually used a book for a setting before? Without actually having the actual material?
Yes, I did.
Oh.
I've read the novel of The Godfather, and I ran a one-shot of The Godfather with players using D20 Modern, players being members of the Corleone family.
Now, that's so, one I had not heard of before.
Yeah.
That's a unique one, right?
That's my vote for the most unique one.
And it worked pretty well as a one-shot. I can't really see it carrying on a whole campaign, unless you intend on having a high body count in your players.
Well, you know what I'm thinking is that definitely for like your mini campaigns that you were mm-hmm. just talking about, if you have like a book setting that you want to do, that might be perfect for a mini campaign.
Exactly. Yeah, I was actually considering doing a Harry Potter. Little one or mini campaign eventually.
All right. Well, I think that's just about it for that. I think we're just going to go off into the comment section, which we actually don't really have any this week. Tony Law actually sent us. What was that?
I said boo.
Oh, well, there were a few minor comments. Tony Law sent us an email reminding us about, yes, the he realized that at the time that we recorded, there were no additional dates past the submission date, end date, which they corrected, and obviously we put out. There was a gentleman who commented that, no, he did not think the Warhammer Fantasy game was worth the $100. I think he didn't even think it was worth $30.
Yeah.
So, and you know, I respect that. I mean, he made his own command decision that it was not something that he felt was worth $100. Yeah. I can't say because I haven't played it. So,
capitalism is the purest form of democracy. You vote with your wallet.
Right, unless you have no money, then you really can't vote.
Yeah, that's true.
So, that said, if you want to say anything to us, either email us or leave us a voicemail. You can email us at info@rpgcircus.com. You can leave us a voicemail at 1-888-643-6322. That is 1-888-643-6322. Of course, you can also use Skype to call us at RPG Circus. And finally, of course, you can send us a little message via Skype. The username is, obviously, RPG Circus. Do we have any closing comments?
No.
All right. I think we're set.
Excellent. I'm actually kind of happy with that. So I think we're just going to go ahead and give it a big close here for now. And we will see everyone in about 2 weeks. The preceding podcast is released under a Creative Commons 3.0 Attribution US license. For more information, go to creativecommons.org.